Nations, Latin America analysis. So we're going to have to switch gears, and these will be basically calculus variations. So I apologize for the date. Of course, it's not today's date, but that's when I finished preparing my talk. Okay, so so this is work in collaboration with Stefan Kromer. So he was a postdoc at Carnegie Mellon until recently. He's now in Germany, in Cologne. And basically, what we were trying to understand was the how to characterize the effective behavior if you wish, minimizers for energies where there is some dependence on epsilon in there. So that's what's in common, if you wish, between what I'm talking about here and the other talks of today, is that, well, okay, there are no discretizations, but there are epsilons in here, and things are moving fast, and there are oscillations in the problem. And this is very okay. So the bottom line is very close to what Thierry was talking about this morning, namely, so if you are looking at the minimizers for a function like this, so think about the quasi-static framework. There is no dependence on time here. Those minimizers, well, under some coercivity conditions or growth conditions, so there will be some compactness there. They will go, in some sense, to some limit. And the question is, what is the problem that that limit satisfies? So that's exactly the same question that was asked this morning. And here, the framework is the following. So you're going to have energies. So you are integrating over omega. What omega represents depends on the problem. And actually, the whole point of this program is to be very general so that we can have as corollaries of this theory different problems from, say, nonlinear elasticity to image processing to say, the study of foams, etc. And so omega will depend on your problem at hand. F will be the energy density, which depends on position. So you have an isotropy in your model. There will be a fast variable here, so that's oscillating really fast. And F is assumed to be periodic with respect to that variable. And then there is a field U epsilon. And by the way, this should be an epsilon here. And your U epsilon, which may be vector valued, will satisfy a system of PDEs. That's what the A stands for here. So A will be a first-order linear system of PDEs. And we'll go. We'll talk about examples. But for example, you can think about A to be curl, in which case what you have here is just curl of U epsilon equal to 0. And you'd be dealing with an energy depending on gradients. And that's what a lot of the calculus variations that has been developed in the 60s and the 70s and so forth, it's exactly for the type of functionals depending on position and gradients. That's a particular case. Okay, so as I said, what we'd like to do is we'd like to take these energies F epsilon, let epsilon go to 0, look at the asymptotic behavior of these Fs, and there is, and then try to characterize that problem, the limiting problem, the effective problem. And there is a tool in the calculus of variations which is very useful to deal with these problems. And in particular, we are going to look at that asymptotic limit in terms of what we call the gamma limit. And the gamma limit, so of this function, of this family of functionals, I call that F om. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, let me just tell you that basically the gamma limit is essentially the lower semicontinuous envelope of your family of energies. So grosso modo, there are two properties that have to be satisfied. Namely, I will say that that the gamma limit, say with respect to an LP convergence, of f epsilon is a function which I'm going to call here f om if two things happen. The first is basically lower Smith continuity. So if you have a sequence, so LP weak, say, U epsilon which converges weakly to some U in LP, you should have that f om of U is below the limit inf of the in epsilon of the f epsilons of U epsilon. So f om is below, if you wish, all these energies, but it's actually just right there, in that it should be attained by some optimal sequence. So that's the second part to it, which is that given U, you should be able to find an optimal sequence that goes to U in such a way that f om of U is actually attained by this energy. So it's below all of them, but it just touches them. So you can actually get a sequence which is absolute, that's optimal and gets there. And so you cannot do better than that. So when you relax your problem and you let it go, this is where you end. You end in the gamma limit. Essentially, it's the relaxation of this family of problems. Right, okay. So basically what we want to do that is exactly to try to, so we look at the f epsilons. Normally, these functions are not lower Smith continuous because, for example, they describe a phase transition problem, so probably it's a multiple well energy. You may have, your f may be anything but convex, and so this is not at all lower Smith continuous, and so indeed you're forced to relax your problem to get the defective energy. And so what we are doing is that we are adding to 1 and 2 an extra condition in that we are not going to approach U by any sequence U epsilon, but by those that satisfy your PDE. Again, think about curl. So if this was a gradient, you would like to approximate gradients by gradients. Again, that's the typical theory for elasticity. Right, okay. So you want to approximate by sequences which satisfy your PD. Okay. So what I wrote here is a fancy way. So this formula here is a fancy way of writing 1. And this one here is a fancy way of writing 2. That's basically it. So it's just think of it as a matter of language. But what this is saying is that you're going to, given a certain U, you're going to infimize over all possible sequences which converge to U and satisfy your PDE. You're going to infimize over that. You're going to take the limit inf of the energies and see how low do you go. And you should not go too low because this should actually be attained by some subsequence. So that's 2 there. Okay? It's just this language. And okay, these two objects are well defined, and you say that you have a gamma limit when they coincide. So if this object is equal to that, which basically means again that you have 1 and 2 together, so being both satisfied, so when this object is equal to that, then you call that the gamma limit of your problem. And the good news is that most problems in applications, again, from materials to image segmentation, have properties in there that guarantee that the gamma limit exists, and you can actually characterize the gamma limit. And what I mean by characterizing the gamma limit is that you started with an energy that depends, that it's written in integral form here, and you'd like to end up with the limit f om that you'd like to write also as an integral of something else. And the question is, what is the effective energy density? It's not going to be f, of course. Your epsilons are going to disappear in some way. It's going to be something else. What is that something else? Okay, so outline of my talk. I'm going to first go a little bit over this thing of what are these A-free fields? Can we think about interesting examples that hopefully will will be of interest to you. I will go a little bit over the history of these homogenization problems. Then I'll talk about our main result with one microscale, because I'm doing an integral of, let me write here, I'm taking the integral of f of x, now first variable x over epsilon, u epsilon, but you could think about, well, why not f of x over epsilon square, u epsilon, and so on, right? So you could have faster, you could have multiple scales in your problem. The one I'm going to talk about here is the case of one scale. When you get to higher scales, life becomes much more, well, challenging on one side, but also messier. And actually, one has to be a little bit careful with the ratio of the scales. It cannot be just anything you want. And actually, some of those conditions go back to Allaire and Brian and others. Stefan Kromer is now doing the case with more than one microscale. I will concentrate here with just one microscale. So that's this case here. Then I will introduce a tool, and we'll go over that, which is called a two-scale limit for fields which satisfy a system of PDEs. Every field, and then I give you a very brief idea of the proof. Okay, so let me first put this into the context. So you start with, so your domain, your reference domain is some omega, an open bounded set. Your u's in here go from omega and have values in Rm, so each component has values in R, so u is a vector. And then you have this this operator A that acts linearly. So if you wish, A has L components, and the kth component is just a first order linear operator with constant coefficients. Okay, there's nothing fancy about that. Associated to that, of course, if you take Fourier transform, you get this matrix that goes from Rn. You have m components times L, so L times m, and the mk entry in your matrix is just given by that. So this is the Fourier transform. And we are going to assume that this operator we have here is not just totally arbitrary, in that it should satisfy a condition that's called the concentrant condition that was introduced by Murat, François Murat. And basically what that says is that when you look at this operator, say restricted to the sphere, there's an homogeneity here, right? So just take xi to half of norm 1, and the rank should be constant, should not depend on xi. Now, most operators you work with, Maxwell's, divergence, curl, higher order, all that, satisfy this PD, this condition. So this is not very restrictive. But it's very important, and you're going to see why. So, examples. Well, okay, the first one is, well, A0. Nothing is happening there. The other one could be that A of u is 0 if and only if you're dealing with divergence-free fields. When you write down the system of PDEs that's underlying this condition, you do get a system of constant rank. Or, as I mentioned in the beginning of my talk, A of u is 0 if and only if you're dealing with gradients. So curl of u is 0. Again, it's first order. When you write down the condition for the matrix, you get constant rank on the sphere. Also, you can deal higher order. I put here the Haitian, but you can put any order. So nabla to the m will always fit into this framework. And that is, for example, you could deal with linear elasticity, where a of u is 0 if and only if u is a symmetrized gradient. Think about micromagnetics, for example. My u would be the pair mh, Okay, M is a magnetization, H is induced magnetic field. They are related through Maxwell's. And again, that satisfies the constant rank condition. So I'm trying to convince you that this framework is quite general, and you can fold in here a lot of situations. And the bottom line is that the calculus of variations for vector valued maps was very well developed in the 80s and in the 90s. And towards the end of the 90s, there was a lot of interest in actually looking at second order, for example, second order energies depending on high order, including second order. And a lot of the work that was done before was being redone again, because you cannot use it mutatis mutandis, so you had to go through the motions and again try to extend everything. And what I'm saying is that, wait, stop. Don't do that, because you can put it all here. And then you do it once and for all. And by the way, I mean, the reason why we are worrying about energies depending on, for example, second order, is that we are more and more pushed into having to consider those energies. For example, if you work in image processing, the first models from the calculus of variations introduced for image segmentation, the so-called Mumford-Cha models, well, you can set them in some kind of a first-order Sobolev space, right, which then will access to BV or whatever. But we also know that that model, if you just use it as it is with first order, you're going to get problems. For example, there is the so-called formation of stair casings. So you get spurious edges in your images, which should not be there. But if you add second order terms, every time you put an edge, you pay a lot energy-wise. So that has the good taste of actually removing stair casing. Actually, there are models by Tony Shan and others. But then you have to deal with energies that don't stop at the gradient, but go to second gradients, for example. That's one situation, but there are many others. For example, and the interesting thing is that for those of us who work both in imaging and in materials, often the models are the same or very similar. The issues are the same, although the motivation is very different. But also, like, if you work in materials, if you work in dimension reduction problems, and I'm just coming from Naples, where there was a meeting on that. If you work on polycrystalline materials, very thin bulk objects where one dimension disappears on you, and so you get into a membrane or a plate theory, it's also known that it's important to add second-order derivatives, because it's going to basically take into account the interfacial energy between different grains of your material. So again, it's important to use second order. Okay. So let me now, following my outline, stop on the general theory of A-free fields, lower semi-continuity and relaxation. So let's for a moment drop the epsilon. So there is no epsilon in here. So it doesn't matter what you put here. You can fold this into just one big X, and then depending on you. So that's what it is there. So let's first look at this. And again, as I told you, in the case of, well, if you don't have a constraint on you, that's convex analysis. We know that if you relax this, you get the convexification of F, right? That's Jensen's inequality. There's nothing there. If it's the case of gradients where U is curl free, there's a whole theory of Morey in the 60s, and then from then on, many people have worked on that, and I would be here forever to quote them. Also, don't be upset if your name is not quoted, and it should be. But basically, that theory is very well developed. It's very well understood. You replace the notion of convexity by quasi-convexity, and I will probably come back to that in a moment. But it's also quite well understood. So then, later on, or more recently, together with Stefan Mueller, we looked at the case where we don't know much about the operator A, except, as I told you, its constant rank when you restrict it to the sphere. So it cannot be too degenerate. But it can be some, because divergence is somewhat degenerate. Okay, so this is the theorem that tells you when can you expect to have lower semic continuity. As I just said, if F is convex, well, we know that basically you have lower semic continuity of the energy. But otherwise, what can we say? So let's assume that the function F is measurable in X and it's continuous in U. And by the way, if it's not continuous in U, the whole theory goes out the window and you have contra-examples. Measurability in X is important because, again, suppose you're dealing with composite materials where for some X's you have one material, for another X you have another material, you're mixing both. So you have jumps from, you have one energy for some X's, you have another energy for the other X's. So it's important that W is not a lot more than measurable when you jump from one material to the next. And let's assume that F is non-negative. Well, it's an energy density, so that's a reasonable assumption. It has some P growth. Right now I'm taking P strictly between 1 and infinity. Not at p equal to 1 is not interesting. It is very interesting because, again, in terms of materials, that's when you start looking at phenomena like fracture and damage and where you have to go away from the Sobolev setting and go into BVs, SBVs, etc. And so p equal to 1 is very interesting, but, of course, also very complicated as you know, I mean, if you have sequences in L1, bound in L1, you have to deal with measures. But I'll probably come back to that later on. You don't ask much on A. And so the theorem says that you have lower semic continuity. That is, every time that UN goes to U, weakly in LP, and UN satisfies the PDE, therefore U satisfies the PDE because it's linear, right? At least in the sense of distributions. So I would like to know that f of u is lower semi continuous whenever that happens. And the theorem says that, well, okay, that happens if and only if every time you freeze x with respect to the oscillating variable, which here is un. Un is converging weakly, so you can have oscillations there. This should be a quasi-convex, and I'm going to tell you what I mean by that. Okay? A note. The fact that I'm assuming that the PD is satisfied exactly, it could be replaced by conditions a little bit weaker. For example, that you only have convergence in W minus 1P, but then you need to have a strong convergence here. But you can go to negative Sobolev spaces. So what is a quasi-convexity? And by the way, this term goes back to Dacroing, although his definition is... it's similar to ours, but not quite. But basically, it's due to Dacroing, the definition. And you say that it's quasi-convex if the following happens. So suppose that Q is the unit cube. And what you're going to do is you're going to prescribe, you're going to try to look at all possible fields which average to xi. You see the integral of W is u, so the average of this object is xi. And you want to look at all possible perturbations of xi which have the same average, and you'd like to know that the one that has minimal energy is the one that has W equal to zero everywhere. So in terms of elasticity, the notion is the so-called quasi-convexity. And what it says, I can write here. It says in elasticity, you call this quasi-convexity, and it just means that if xi is a matrix, then f of xi is below the integral over the unit cube of f of xi, but here it's curl-free, so it's a gradient, where phi should be periodic with average zero. Um, Or if you wish, you can actually, equivalent to this, you can assume that phi is actually Lipschitz with zero trace on the boundary. So what that means in terms of elasticity is that if I have a cube, if I'm going to deform this cube, and I tell you that the boundary of that cube is deformed linearly as xi of x, you don't have to worry about what happens inside, because the configuration with minimal energy is the one which is affine everywhere. So that is the minimal energy, and I'm sorry, but this is in front of you, so you won't see, but the minimal energy is attained when phi is zero, so that is affine everywhere. And you only have to know what's happening on the boundary. That's the notion of a quasi-convexity. And behind this, there's also something else, which is the fact that when you deal with these problems, you only have to, it's a bit simplified, but it's basically at the end of the day, if you know what happens when you zoom on a point, then you are in good shape. And when you zoom means that instead of a general omega, think about the nicest possible domain, which to me is the unit cube. But the ball would be the same, okay? And what is the nicest possible u that has that's a free? Well, it's a constant. It's xi. So if you know what happens to what happens when you blow up, when you zoom on a point and you fix the point and you have the best possible domain, then grosso modo you know what's going to happen once you step back and look at the big picture. Okay, so again, in the case of when A of u is identical equal to zero, A convex, quasi-convexity is just convexity. That means you're just averaging over W's that have average zero. As you know, that's the convexified envelope. It's the convex envelope. In the case of curl equal to zero, I just talked about that here, then this reduces to Morris quasi-convexity, which is what I wrote over there for those who can see that part of the board. Okay. We also treated the case p equal to 1. There's a magical dimension here, but don't worry about that. Take p equal to 1, and then, again, if you have f which is quasi-convex for x fixed with some p Lipschitz condition, which is pretty innocuous, then you actually have lower semi-continuity, but now here, of course, your un is going to converge to some Radon measure because you only have L1 bounds. And this is just the Radon-Nikodym derivative of lambda with respect to Ln. We don't know what happens to the other terms because lambda is going to have a singular part. Why not? In the case of curl-free fields, this would be, lambda would be the derivative of a function of bounded variation, in which case we know exactly how it looks like. And in the case of gradients, we know what happens also. You can add to these something depending on the singular part. In the case of p equal to 1, we don't know. And the reason is this, is that the theory that is used to develop this theory, this theorem, and the theorem, this theorem, and this one here, is based on Fourier multipliers and Fourier multipliers are pretty well understood in LP for p bigger than 1, but for p equal to 1, they're not. And so that's the problem, that you cannot deal with these. We don't know much for p equal to 1. So there's still a lot of work to be done in the case of linear growth, which is very interesting, as I said, because there are a lot of physical situations in which you should go down to p equal to 1. You should work with measures. You should not work anymore with functions, but with measures. Okay, what about relaxation? Okay, that was work with Andrea Brides and Giovanni Leoni. And he said, well, okay, take a u, which is in LP. It's a free, so it's in the kernel of your operator. Again, p between 1 and infinity. If you're going to look, if you remember what I told you about the gamma limit, sub gamma limit, if it's basically these two together, but if you drop the epsilon, it writes like this. So you take the inf over possible ways of approaching u, over sequences which satisfy the PDE. You look at the limit if of the energies, that's something. And it turns out that that something can be written as an integral. And it's indeed another integral of something else which we call QA. And QA is just the quasi-convex, the envelope of f with respect to this operator. What you have to do is, so you take for x fixed, you make all possible perturbations, x is fixed. You integrate in y, so for x fixed, you take your xi, you perturb xi with fields which satisfy your PDE and have average zero. This is just to basically get rid of what's, this is just a normalization, okay? So that's just, again, in the case where a is zero, what you have is the convex envelope. There's nothing else. You're just infimizing over fields that have the same average. Okay. Again, there is quite a leap from the A quasi-convex case, that's the case of gradients, to the general case of A quasi-convex. In particular, if you start with a function which is just Borel measurable and you quasi-convexify, so if you're working with gradients, you always obtain a continuous function, always. However, with A quasi-convexity, that's not true, so it's very different from quasi-convexity. And the problem is that if F is not continuous, then the relaxed energy that I just showed you here, written as an integral, may not even be a Radon measure with respect to the domain of integration. So it can never be written as an integral. It will be non-local. And so that's an example of a simple example. You don't have to go through this, but a very simple PDE where it's just u prime 2 equal to 0. I take this f, which is, of course, discontinuous. And if you relax your energy, this is what you get. It's, of course, non-local. You cannot write this as a single integral. Okay, it's a simple example. Again, even if f is continuous, its envelope with respect to A quasi-convexity may not be continuous. And again, another example, same operator as before. U has two components, but you're going from R into R2. A of U is U is just saying that U prime 2 is 0. By the way, this is constant rank, because that matrix W is just this. So on the sphere, it's always of rank 1. So it satisfies all your conditions. And still with this particular f, when you quasi-convexify, you get something which is discontinuous. So it's a bit different to work with this object than working with quasi-convexity. And more, because think, for example, if A equal to 0 is, for example, saying that U is a Hessian. When we have gradients, what happens is that in terms of the analysis, you don't work directly on the gradients. If you want to truncate, if you want to do this and the other, you will do it on the potential, and then you take the gradient. If you start truncating a nation, you have a problem, because it's no longer a nation, right? So if you truncate third-order derivatives, you get a mess. And so that's the problem, is that you cannot... How do you work directly on a field that satisfies a certain PDE without... messing up your PDE. And again, in terms of gradients, you don't worry because you work with the U, you don't work with the grad U. So you have to think a little bit differently. Okay, I should also say that not only can deal with gradients, but you can deal, for example, with functions depending on U, grad U, and several derivatives. Previous results that will not that were obtained in the theory of Morey and others for gradients cannot be pushed automatically because again you cannot truncate directly higher order derivatives. But also other examples, for example, it's the case where what you do, you're dealing with x, u grad u, and in addition to that you impose that the divergence is u and so on. So there are many examples you can treat within this framework. Okay, so let's go back to our situation, which is the one we started with, and that's where you have epsilons in the picture. Okay, so that was the case. We know epsilons. You pretty much now understand what's going on. Let's look at what happens if now I put epsilons in the problem. So I start with an F. Again, with respect to the first variable, I want to have only measurability because, again, think about two materials, material one and material two, and I want to start mixing more and more and more with finer and finer grains. That's your X over epsilon in a periodic way, but I want the grains to be smaller and smaller. And so it should not be continuous because I'm jumping from one cell to the next, very small rescaled cells from material one to material two, and definitely with respect to this variable, it should be discontinuous. That's the one that's going to oscillate very fast. With respect to X, with respect to your field, it's going to be continuous. It's periodic, say with period the unit cell. Again, F is non-negative, and it has some P growth for P bigger than 1. And here, I call your attention to the fact that F is bigger than or equal to 0. And to our knowledge, this is the first result that's done on homogenization within the calculus variation, so in this framework, where F is non-coercive. So even for gradients, where here what you have is a gradient, in the literature until now, F was always coercive. That is, from below, you have a P growth, as you have from above, uniformly in epsilon. And that's not a good thing, because, again, in the materials framework, you expect often that the thing is going to generate. The generate and the bounce from below have no reason to be uniform in epsilon. They may actually go to zero in some direction. And again, you see, once I resolve this problem and I get homogenization in this general framework, I will also get it for gradients. So I get for free a generalization of what is known, and now without coercivity. So on one hand, I'm going to have to suffer a little bit because I cannot use the usual methods of the Coxon variations, but on the other hand, I will gain considerably at the end of the day. And again, in particular, you're going to gain in non-assuming coercivity in here. So we call this is what you have. I don't know why I keep putting your epsilon in. I'm sorry, but there should be no epsilon in there. It's just the energy of U should be X over. That's the only epsilon in here. That should be U. Sorry about that. And I'm looking at the effective energy in this sense. Again, it's sense 1 and 2, which is what is the optimal way to get to U by minimizing these energies and letting it settle, relax. And the theorem says that, okay, so you take a U in LP that satisfies your PDE, and then indeed you can write it as an integral, depending, now of course the epsilon's now disappeared, there are no more epsilons, it has been homogenized, depends on X, on U of X, and we have a formula for X and U of X. And basically what the formula says is that F ohm, so for X and for a fixed Xi, is what? Well, again, you take your Xi, perturb Xi with Vs which satisfy the PDE, which have average zero, that's just to normalize. Otherwise, you get constants. You don't want constants in there, right? So you get rid of the constants by assuming these. And here, you put the N here is here. An equivalent way of writing this is don't put an N there, but instead of using Q, you have to average over larger and larger and larger cells. And by the way, that goes back to Stefan Müller with gradients, that he realized that, you know, when you homogenize, in the case of gradients, vector-valued gradients, you need one cell is not enough. Your effective energy is going to see an infinite number of cells, because I said change of variables it basically just means that you're averaging over NQ with no N in there. And there are actually examples that show that if you just look at the cell for N equal to 1, that's not enough. So you need to have this family of cells. Okay. So again, what is the big deal? The big deal is, as I told you, is that we are now, we managed to do this whole analysis without coercivity. And basically, going back in time, in the AFI context, we did do homogenization with no epsilon. Well, okay, with epsilon, but in the AFI context, but F did not depend on X. It was continuous here. That's not good. And I can say that. I was one of the authors. So so I don't feel bad about that. But again, as I told you, this is your Y here, and it should not be continuous here. But at the time, we didn't know better. And F was coercive. Okay. Now, in the case of gradients, so A is equal to curl, so that's your situation. There's a huge body of literature. And for example, in the convex case, in the case of gradients, carbonyl diacylglycerols, they did not impose coercivity, but there was no dependence on X. And in addition to that, you didn't have oscillations because they assumed that here, instead of having U epsilon oscillating to U, you had strong uniform convergence. Well, again, most of the time you don't have strong convergence. Things oscillate, right? That's the theme of this workshop. So they had L-infinity strong convergence. Or that's the same. B is bigger than N, so you're back to L-infinity strong. And so, again, many other cases, also with my former student, we did do the quantum convex case, but again, we had coercivity. Okay. So, what are the tools? The tools are, as I said, the George's gamma convergence and the so-called two-scale convergence. The definition is basically written there. If you have a sequence U epsilon, we say that U epsilon two-scale converges to a certain W, W not depending on two variables, so you're kind of like unfolding the fast variable. You're going from functions that depend on one variable to functions that depend on two variables, the slow and the fast variable. That's the fast variable living on the period cell. And so this is just one variable. U epsilon so converges to W. If when you multiply by test function of this type, periodic in the fast variable, this converges to this object. That's called two-scale convergence. I'll come back to that later. And also, we are going to use the so-called unfolding operator that was introduced by Sioranescu, Damamian, and Grisot, and also independently by Augusto Vizintin. And then there is the composition lemma that Stefan Müller and myself studied. Gamma convergence, basically, it's written there on the board. That's what gamma convergence is. It's properties 1 and 2. What is the composition lemma? The composition lemma says the following. So suppose that you have that you start with a sequence, a bounded sequence in LP, and suppose that they satisfy the PD. So they are A-free. Think of gradients, for example. Suppose that you and are in a Sobolev space, which and they are bounded in W1P. Okay, and you're looking at the gradients. So what the lemma says is that there's a subsequence such that you can write your subsequence as Vn plus Zn, where this one now is P equintegrable, so this to the power P is equintegrable. The first one is not, because this one is only converging in LP weak. So when you take the pth power, you have L1 bounds, but it's not equintegrable. So you're going to have concentrations. Okay, you're going to have concentrations here to the power p. But you can decompose in two. One is the pth power is equintegrable. And the remaining, which is Zn, which is this different here, is pretty innocuous. Actually converges to zero strongly. And and this is actually the miracle that when you do lower semicontinuity, you use this all the time. And so it's a way of replacing a non-equintegrable sequence by one that's equintegrable with a little bit of an error, but the error is not a big deal. I have to stress that, of course, it's true only for a subsequence. It's not usually it's not true for the whole sequence, okay? But it's always a subsequence which will satisfy this property. And that's a very powerful tool. Now let me tell you what is two-scalar convergence. So you take a W which now has two variables. The slow variable lives in omega, that's your x. The fast variable is the y, but I have everything periodic, so I can extend to the whole R as periodic. And I say that a sequence U epsilon 2-scale weakly converges to W. And that's true. I gave you already the definition. If and only so, I'm characterizing what are these objects. If and only if W satisfies the following property. So when I take the first moment with respect to the fast variable, and I call that a W0 bar, that satisfies still the PDE. And when I subtract from W this first moment, I get something that now depends on both Y0 and Y1. And with respect to the Y1, should also satisfy the PDE. This generalizes the result by Knudsen, Allaire and Brian, and many others for the case of gradients. So in the case where A is equal to curl, your two-scale limits of gradients are fields that can be written as a gradient plus something else which is a gradient on a fast variable. And with respect to U0, you don't know much except some integrability properties, but that could be just measurable. That theory has been very well developed. Okay, so let me remind you in the rest of my time what was the main theorem. So this was the theorem, right? So you start with this. H0 to H2, if I'll just remind you briefly, it's basically periodicity here and growth condition and no coercivity. And so the theorem says that take a U in LP that satisfies the PDE. And when you relax your problem, this is what you get. And again, I remind you, the F ohm was an inf over limit inf of, which you can also write this way, as essentially the problem on the unit cell, but you take multiples of y, or equivalently, take the integral over average of the bigger and bigger cells, but then drop the n here. And you're going to perturb C by fields which have average zero that have satisfied the PDE, and you're going to eliminate constants out of your problem. Okay, so let me see. I don't know if I have time to go through this, but the first step is we are going to unfold the problem. And so I start with a problem that dependent on this, basically on one variable, but this was a slow and this was a fast variable, and now I'm going to unfold it. So now I'm going to go from an integral in omega to an integral over omega times unit cell. And there I can prove, and I'm not going to go through that because it's a paper, it's very big, but basically you can prove with the methods I told you that you can unfold it and you can actually get a representation for your homogenization as this object. Now W depends on the slow and the fast variable. Again, with respect to the fast variable, satisfies the PDE with respect, and you're ruling out constants. But that was not what we wanted, right? We don't want two. We don't want an omega and a Q. We just want an omega. So now you have to fold it back, right? And so now you have to fold it. So basically, you have to prove that this business that depends on the fast and the slow can be collapsed in just this one. And this was just the two spaces. I mean, this is just, again, fields here that satisfy the PDE, average zero, and these are the ones that do that, but X is free pretty much, and you only care about the fast variable. That's the big deal, is that you're not saying much about X, and X is pretty free. Okay. So let's see. Again, I may not have time to do all this, but let me go over some of the ingredients. The first, so let me move fast here. And one is that this, what we call F ohm, which is this object, you can write these as actually an if over just a countable family of test functions. If I can do that, then of course this object is going to be measurable. So it will be this, because the limit if of measurable functions. And then you can use Fatou's lemma and all that. And just so that I can give you an idea why you need constant rank. That's something I talked in the beginning. That's a place where you need constant rank, because how you get this countable dense set, it's the following. You just take, because A is of constant rank, there is a projection from functions which are periodic into functions which are periodic in such a way that basically what you have is Poincaré. So you take U, you subtract its projection, and you can bound that by your PDE now in the W minus 1. That's Poincaré inequality, period. That's all. If you take gradient, you have Poincaré. So you see how U is far from its projection with this operator by looking at this. In particular, of course, if U satisfies the PDE, the projection of U is U. So that's why it's a projection. Okay. And so, how do you construct V0? That's easy. You take a countable dense set in LP. LP is separable. P is bigger than 1 and less than infinity. And then, just instead of the Vs here, just project them, subtract their average. These objects have average 0, satisfy your PDE, so they are in this space, and they are going to be countable and dense because you have these bits. So this lets you approximate your Vs by its projections. Okay, so and without trying to bother you too much with details, another thing that it's interesting that we use is a very easy measurable selection criterion. And so those of you who have worked with Kalkstad variations, at some point you have to use some kind of a measurable selection criterion, and you go and you take all your favorite ones, say, oh, man's measurable selection criterion or whatever, and the proof is very, very, very complicated. It's very involved. And this is very interesting here, and I would like to go over that, because that's a measurable selection criteria that, as far as I know, works pretty much almost all the time, and the proof is here. So, and it goes like this. So again, you have a multifunction that goes from a measurable space into the parts of a sum separable metric space. All you ask is that, given a T, gamma of T will be non-empty, will be open. That's not bad. And also, you ask that these inverse images of the set of T's, where this gamma of T is measurable. And again, most of the cases I've been dealing with satisfy that. And then the lemma says that you can find a measurable selection criteria. So you can find a gamma that takes from a T to a gamma T that leaves in gamma of T, and this is a measurable selection. The proof is right here, and it's very simple. I mean, I'm not probably going to go through that, but believe me, that's all here. There's nothing else. This is the proof. Okay. But for example, if you have worked with dimension reduction problems, you have had, I'm pretty sure, to deal with measurable selection criterions, and probably have to go through more complicated proofs than this. Okay, so let me see. Do I really want to go over all this? Probably not. I just want to finish by, and I go back here, that there is another ingredient in our proof that turned out to be very useful, and let me see if I can find it somewhere. Here, it's here, which is the fact that we realized something, namely that one of the reasons why people use coercivity is that at some point in the proofs, you're going to end up with like double limits, and then you have to diagonalize your sequences. And in order to diagonalize, you need to have coercivity plus separability, right? And we realize that we do not have to diagonalize because, and this is not particular, it's general. It doesn't have to do anything with, am I going backwards or forward? I don't know. This has nothing to do with the A3 context. Again, go back to gradients, is the same. We just realized that the homogenized energy can be written actually as a limit, always. And it's always a limit, provided that you don't take n, but you take n factorial. It may seem very strange, but it's true, and I don't have time here to go over that. It has to do with rescaling arguments and periodicity and all that. But if one realizes that the homogenized energy is indeed a limit all the time, then you don't have to diagonalize anything, you don't have to use coercivity, and everything goes through, provided, again, you use all these techniques. And I think I pretty much use my time. They don't have the same time. But anyway, I'll stop here. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
What is going to be different in the case that the SAR conditions have non-constant coefficients?
Sorry? Oh, God, Hilbert rules. First of all, okay, if they don't have constant, so like depending on, well, okay, if the rank is the same uniformly, you're okay. So you have A, you have the things depending on, so what you want is, in the beginning you want A, X, Aij of x, is that what you want? Oh,
when
but
you
even
just localize or
sorry,
you just freeze with x or
no. Okay, the short answer to you want to put an x.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Even and it has nothing to do with homogenization, because even if you do lower semi-continuity, just what I told you before, like what the theory I developed with Stefan Müller and I developed, it's not done. So if you don't have constant coefficients, I don't know how to do that at all. So you have to even go back. It's not even, forget about the epsilons. Go back to just plain. Now, I would suspect that you need to at least have here a rank which, okay, they're going to have x's in here. That should maybe be uniform in x. But even so, it's complicated, because you see, when you take the Fourier transform, now you're going to have other terms that are going to appear because of your dependence on x. It's not just Fourier on the gradients, right? So I don't know, because this whole thing is very much anchored on spherical harmonics and Fourier multipliers. It's basically, I mean, go to Stein's book or something like that. And you need to have constant coefficients. You have to go into some of the theory. I'm not saying it's not important, I'm just saying I have no clue.
Okay, so another question? No? Thank you very much.